And welcome to Weather and Ag in Focus at 106 in the afternoon on this Monday, January 6th. And hope everybody had a good weekend. I'm Chief Meteorologist Dean Wysocki, along with our Ag Director Bridget Riedel. And we've got a fun day ahead today. We've got a fun night tonight, if you're a Bison fan. And boy, the weather down in Frisco is chilly.
Super chilly.
Yeah, it is chilly as... temperatures down there this morning, wind chills were at 6 above. Now, kickoff temperature down in Frisco is supposed to be about lower 30s to maybe middle 30s. Let's figure lower 30s and a little bit of a breeze producing wind chills in the teens. So hopefully everybody is bundled up down there. And if you know anybody down there and they're planning on staying an extra day or two, might want to tell them to get out of Dodge by Wednesday night. A pretty decent storm system is moving through the southern plains on Thursday into Friday, and quite a bit of snow expected through northern Texas and especially Oklahoma. So that trip back, if they left on Thursday, could be, if they left Thursday or Friday, could be a problem. So games tonight, spend a day down there to recover after a big victory, and then leave Wednesday before the storm arrives down to our south. So that's the best advice for anybody that's down there right now.
So with that comes through later, that is all staying to the south. You said get out of town by Wednesday down south, and it's all staying south of us. We don't have anything coming back up this way.
No, we've got a clipper system that'll be coming our way as we head towards later this week.
Could it get colder?
Could it get any? No, it'll actually warm us up. So at least initially it'll warm us up. But we do have some pretty... I don't want to say decent weather, but at least better than we have been, with temperatures finally starting to warm up as we head throughout the week this week. We're currently in the single digits, and we'll stay there the rest of the afternoon with a northwest wind on the light side. And tonight we'll see a few clouds come in, lows between about 2 and 5 below, with a northwest wind at 5 to 10. And winds increase just a touch tomorrow, northwest 5 to 15. And highs once again in the single digits with wind chills, oh, about 10 to 15 below tomorrow afternoon. So tomorrow afternoon will feel a little colder than today due to the winds. And then we'll finally start a brief warm-up as we head into Wednesday with highs in the teens. Clouds roll back on Thursday, and we'll see a clipper system bring some light snow. Doesn't look like a big deal, about an inch, maybe two, but right now, we'll say about 1 to 2 inches, and then we'll stay in the upper teens to low 20s on Friday, and a stronger clipper system looks like it's coming our way over the weekend. That could deposit an additional 2 to 3 inches and some wind behind that, so we could have some travel issues possibly over the weekend, especially on Sunday, as winds ramp up with any fresh snowpack. Now, we've got about three, according to the LRC, we've got about three clipper systems, maybe four, but three for sure, heading our way starting later this week through about the third week or the end of the month. So that should add to some of the snowpack that we've got, which we're lacking out there. This is good news not only for moisture but also for our snowmobiler friends. And this afternoon's weather update is sponsored by Ryan Bonesack with Equitable AgriFinance, providing long-term fixed rates for farmland financing. He's here to help our local farmers and ranchers. Give him a call if you need his assistance at 701-261-6529. And we could use some more snow around here, and we're finally starting to see signs of that with about, like I said, three or four clipper systems between this week and the end of the month. So that should add a little bit to the snowpack out there. We need the moisture. I don't see any big, big storms with a lot of snow. But, hey, each one of these clipper systems, you drop a couple inches here or there, and it adds up. It helps.
Well, it does. And, you know, it's interesting that folks that are headed south are seeing far more snow than we really have here right now. And last weekend, but you know, as the cold weather was, just as it was settling in, I was headed to the Valley City area last Saturday. And surprisingly, when you got north of Arisca, I thought there was more snow there than what we have here. So we don't have a lot of snowpack. We'll see what it does through the winter months. Sometimes it's just nice to have that cover more than anything else. Ground's froze pretty hard.
Yeah, it is. And it's good for vegetation. And like I said, we'll get more snowpack here over the next couple of weeks. No big storm like they had down in the Central Plains. Boy, I'll tell you, from Kansas City all the way to Washington, D.C., I believe it was Kansas City's fourth largest snowfall in a 24-hour period. So that says something right there. And
I loved hearing people call over the weekend and say, take your weather back. I'm like, hey, we don't need it right now. You're fine.
It was definitely one for the record books down there. But like I said, they can have it. They need the moisture as well. And we'll be watching. That storm will be back in the LRC cycle, I believe, third week in February, and then again at the beginning of April. Now, when this came through on the first cycle, this brought us quite a bit. This is the one that brought us the big rain in November. It stayed south this time, and odds are there's about a 70% chance in the next cycle, end of third week in February, that more than likely will stay south as well. It depends on what there's a couple other factors, and if those are the same as they are now, that system will definitely stay south. If not, that could pull north at the third week in February. April, it's more than likely to have more of an impact on us as that jet stream lifts north towards spring. So,
well,
something to look forward to.
Yeah, we'll see what it does. And I so often hear folks saying, well, you know, are we going to catch up in the moisture? Well, we did last year. We normally do. Mother Nature tends to figure out a way to balance things out, and that really makes a difference for all of us.
Yeah, and I'm not foreseeing drought conditions going into the spring. That's good news. Summer might be a different story, but let's concentrate on spring right now. Since we had ample moisture in the fall, at least with that one system, that'll be our wild card storm. If that misses us the next two or three cycles, then we might be looking at a different scenario come spring.
You know, and drought doesn't even concern me. There's a difference between a drought and good growing conditions. And, you know, you've got plenty of farmers that last year said, yeah, it dried out. We had a kind of a flash drought later in the season, but we really pulled off a good crop. So that was okay. Even those who garden notice a difference, that it's kind of nice not to be so terribly wet through some of the season. That really can impede us. And you know, a good talking point about that will probably happen on Friday when we are joined by Don Kinsler. And we can talk about, you know, sometimes it's nice not to have so much moisture in the soil. We've had a lot of years of just wildly wet, but it'll get better, much better. And if you are looking to visit with guys like Don, first of all, keep that in mind for Friday, because today's Monday. He's going to join us on Friday. Finally, a full week. We might know what day it is around here. It's been a little troublesome. If you are interested in attending meetings where people like Don attend, particularly hosted by North Dakota State University Extension Service, this week, Lake Region Roundup is Wednesday and Thursday in Devil's Lake. That is 2 days of packed information for production farming. You have an opportunity to visit with other farmers that are there. You get a chance to talk with them about what is happening in each of their industries, which I think is fantastic. Then also after the roundup is going to have a featured guest speaker. My buddy Rob Sharkey is going to be there. So looking forward to hearing how that goes for him. This week is the National Potato Expo in Orlando. We will have soon the KMOT Ag Expo out in Minot. That's the end of January, right about the time we have the North Harvest Bean Growers Association meeting here in Fargo. The Advanced Crop Advisors kicks off February for us here in Fargo, the 11th and 12th. The week before that will be Agronomy on Ice on February 5th on Devil's Lake. So 2/5/25 to that one. And so many more. Some of the big events that are coming up, National Cattlemen's Beef Association will be the beginning of February. We will also have Commodity Classic March 2nd to the 4th in Denver. So mark your calendars if you wanted to go to a meeting about farming. There's a bunch. In fact, I leave for one tomorrow.
I was just going to say, you'll be down in Kansas City.
I will be heading to Kansas City tomorrow morning. I've already called ahead and asked them to clean that crap off the roads. We're going to need a little less ice down there, please. But Kansas City this week will be hosting FarmCon. That's put on by the Kevin Van Trump Group and Ag Swag. And one of the reasons I'm going is, first of all, the interaction. There's about 1,200 farmers that will be in attendance. Get an opportunity to visit with them. It's very much a professional setting. There'll be lots of discussion from grain marketing, economic outlook folks. Some of their more entertaining guest speakers will be, let me see, I think his name is Jim Craig. He is he was one of the guys on the 1980 Miracle on Ice hockey team.
Oh, nice.
So I'll get a chance to visit with him. And then additionally, the guy who is the head of Disney Imagination and Innovation is a speaker while we're there. And so is the guy who's the head of Harley-Davidson Communications. So looking forward to hearing all of those guys speak. And
why would the head of Harley be down at a farm?
When you think about communications and how to do them well, think about when he took over as communications for Harley, they were in a bad spot. Mm. And they were trying to recover a lot of market share. And he brought them up out of that hole, you might say. So his name is Ken Schmidt. And then Duncan Wardle is the head of innovation and creativity at Disney. And it is Jim Craig, who part of the 1980 Olympic Miracle on Ice hockey team.
Great. And rumor has it somebody is going to be receiving an award down there, huh?
I will. I will be one of the top 50, recognized as one of the top 50 social media in ag. So looking forward to seeing what that entails. I'll have a chance to visit with Gary Lisak while I'm down there. Gary's on the main stage with Kevin Van Trump. There's a lot of exciting things on Wednesday and Thursday.
Good deal. He'll be talking about the LRC and how it affects our ag community.
In front of a whole room of farmers.
Perfect.
And from there, I head up to Red Wing, Minnesota on Saturday morning. I speak to Minnesota Farm Bureau's LEAP Conference. It is their leadership, education, and advocacy program. So I'll be in Red Wing, Minnesota on Saturday.
Good deal. Good deal. And our guest coming up here.
Yes, we are going to be visiting with Mike Fitzgibbon. He's with the Mid-America Windmill Museum. For those who didn't know there was a windmill museum, frankly, neither did I until I found Mike. But I'm excited to hear what he has to share about the history of windmills in general in the U.S. He said one of the hardest parts is so many of those experts are passing away. There's folks that worked on them, and you know, we just don't have quite the prevalence of people helping out with windmills. So we'll be talking to Mike here in just a few minutes. Make sure to check out the American Ag Network markets next, and then stay tuned for our guest, Mike Fitzgibbons. Welcome back to Weather and Ag in Focus. Thanks for joining us today. Whether you are out hauling grain, which, that's cold, and I hope all the trucks started, and maybe you're in the office doing paperwork because it's that time of the year to get it ready. Just wanted to make sure that you knew we were happy you were here, as well as happy to have our guest joining us, Mike Fitzgibbon. He's with the Mid-America Windmill Museum. Mike, how are you today?
I'm good, Bridget. Thank you. The weather's a little about the same as what you're seeing. We didn't get any of that storm that hit the Midwest last night. We just have an inch or two of residual snow on the ground, but doing fine.
Okay. Where are you? Where's the museum? This is probably not something folks are familiar with, is the locale.
We're in Kendallville, Indiana, which is north of Fort Wayne, Indiana, about 25 miles to the north and the west.
And how long has this museum been in existence? I mean, windmills have been around for quite some time.
Yeah, we opened up in 1994, in the spring of 1994. We're one of two large collections of windmills. There's also a windmill museum out your way, if you will, west of the Mississippi. It's called the American Windmill Museum. And then we're the largest collection of mills on the east side of the Mississippi, located in Kendallville, Indiana. So we have the country covered, if you will, if people are interested in viewing the history of windmills and seeing the windmills that are on display.
You do have it covered, much as windmills have across the prairies for generations. So tell us a little bit more about that. The windmill is an iconic symbol of pasture land, of prairie land. They extend pretty much in every area of the U.S. at some point, but give us a little bit of history, if you could.
Yeah, early history is they began with the European post mill. It was developed in Europe between the 12th and the 19th century. I'm going to give you just a little bit of history. I won't spend too much time on it, but as I was doing research for the interview today, I wanted to learn a little bit about, you know, the early history before the American history of it, if you will. The use of the post mills spread throughout England and Europe, generally east to west, by the 1300s, so quite a long time ago. Windmills could be found in Spain, France, Belgium, Netherlands, Denmark, Germany, and Italy. As they spread and multiplied, more sophisticated variations of the post mill were built. Although the European windmills, which were the post mills, floundered in the New World colonies, which is the Americas, if you will, it did find limited use. In 1621, Virginia Governor George Yeardley constructed the first windmill, the post windmill, in Jamestown, Virginia. And then in the 1720s, William Robertson constructed an English post mill near Williamsburg, Virginia. And I'll say that that windmill is still in existence. They have a museum there that has a post mill, and we actually have a replica of that post mill on our grounds in Kendallville, Indiana. It's very interesting. It's gone through some restoration over the years. It's been out here. We've had it for almost 20 years now. So we've gone through some recent restoration and so on.
Quick question
it's
there,
on
Mike. When you talk about a post mill, how does that differ from what most of us would know for a windmill? Does it differ?
Well, yes, it does. The post mill is basically a small house, if you will, setting up on a post that has a shaft coming out of it with blades that have sails put on them. And it's a very large, bulky windmill. And that's why it didn't really spread throughout the United States, if you will, in the early days, because it was such a big, major construction. I'd sent you a link to our website at some point.
We
could take a look at the pictures on that. But it's quite different. It's like a house sitting on a it's more akin to the mills in Holland, if you will, with the large fixed windmills, and mainly used for grain grinding. It was not used for water pumping.
Oh.
It was more of a horsepower mill for grain grinding. That's why it really didn't catch on as far as with the farmers and so on.
Okay, when you say comparing that to like Holland, okay, that makes a lot more sense. Dutch windmills kind of makes sense,
yeah.
But you're saying that
that
house was actually elevated in the air.
Right, it sits on a post, and then that post, the house could be moved with a shaft on the end and push into the wind, and that they would grind grain. But as you know, when there wasn't wind, there was no work. that was one of the drawbacks of windmills. But that led to the way of the American windmills in the 19th century. Just a little about that. Now we've jumped ahead a little bit to the 19th century because it's more of the American windmill bore little resemblance to the European process, as you've seen in the fields out your way and in the plains. It was a small, multi-blade, light, movable, self-regulating, and was easy to maintain. And it was also relatively inexpensive in those days.
Mm-hmm.
The windmill itself, obviously, it was the Western environment that created the demand. In 1857, Daniel Holliday formed the Holliday Windmill Company. And he was in Connecticut, obviously close to the post mill, but he was an inventor that said, we've got to invent a windmill that's more user-friendly, if you will. So then he moved his company to Batavia, Illinois, and the Holliday was the first commercially produced American windmill. And it was a wooden wheel, wooden tail, and, of course, on a wooden frame. But it did have metal and mechanical parts made of steel and so on. But
okay.
It was basically the first of the commercial windmills. And there's not, when you look out in the plains and stuff, there's rarely any of those around anymore. We have several on display at our museum, and they have several at the American Museum, Windmill Museum there in Lubbock, Texas.
Okay,
but
so
most of them now are being preserved, yep.
The way you talked about that, when you said, okay, the way a windmill looks, most of us are familiar with the big fan blade, so to speak, on the front.
The wheel, yep.
The wheel. But then the back end of that is called the tail. And what you're saying is that they were originally wooden. They then changed to metal. And if I'm not mistaken, even stone tails could be a possibility, right?
Now, I've never seen any. There's counterweights on some of them like could be stones or could be metal. They're made of many different shapes. There's horses, chickens, ball weights, and some of those were counterweights that were on the backside in order to offset the weight of the blade so that when the mechanism turned, it was more balanced and took some of the side load off the bearings and so on that were holding it up onto the top of the the base itself.
Okay.
So what you're describing, and I've seen some, we actually have some down in our restoration barn that are made out of stone, if you will, but those are counterweights.
Well, we've got
that's actually you found that. Yeah. You must have. That is actually one of them right there. Yeah.
All right. So
that's a holiday standard. And we have, you know, one of the only ones in the existence that we know of. There's a few around, but these are housed in a barn to protect them.
Well, when you can see them right there, for those who want to see those photos, you can reach us on the live stream. We are live streaming on Facebook and YouTube under Weather and Ag in Focus here at WDAY. You can also find us on Acres TV, where we live stream every day on their app. So when we return, Mike, there's more questions for us to ask. And of course, anyone can reach us on our phone line of 701-293-9000, or you can send emails weather@flagfamily.com. And there's more to ask about those types of windmills that we've seen, what they've done. You know, the Dutch windmills were definitely associated with grinding grain, but I think ours here were a little bit more different on the prairie, and we'll touch on that when we return. Welcome back to Weather and Ag in Focus. As usual, we are having a fabulous day here. Don't forget that later today, we will be giving you a chance to win part of a Desperado Vegas Dream Vacation presented by American Security and Gate and brought to you in part by Frontier Airlines and Kingpin Social. You can join Janae, one of the hosts of the Coffee Club, today at 3:00 at Kingpin Social for your chance to get registered. Round fare airfare for two on Frontier Airlines from Fargo to Vegas, hotel stay, two tickets to the Eagles on Saturday, January 25th at the Sphere, and $500 in spending cash. Please do make sure you swing in for that. So our discussion today is with Mike Fitzgibbon. He is with the Mid-America Windmill Museum. Mike, we've been talking about kind of the history of windmills and so forth, and Dean and I have several questions. One of them is, as you look at the windmills we have had here on the prairies and in the U.S., you mentioned that the European windmills really were there to grind grain. Are our windmills primarily functioning for water or for a different type of energy? What were our windmills doing?
Yeah, our windmills were primarily for water pumping. There were a few that were, we call them a power mill, and we have one on display that actually, when the wind turns, it turns a rotating shaft that goes into a building and drives a shaft that would have pulleys on for belts that you could have used it for anything on the farm side, grain sifters, corn shellers. On the manufacturing side, they would have used it to run a small drill press in a shop, a small grinding wheel and such. So, but those were very few. We hunted high and low to find one of those, primarily water pumping mills. And just a highlight of that, here's what built the water pumping windmills built the rail system going west, you know, back in the late 1800s, early 1900s. Obviously, you had steam locomotives, and they had to have a water pumping station every 50 miles, roughly, to keep those steam locomotives going. So as the rail system started to develop itself west of Chicago, and that's where the Holiday windmill was taken on by the Western Railroad builders, and they dotted the whole Western Plains. And then also what that caused was for the cattle ranchers that had cattle drives, if you think about it, down in Texas or so, and they wanted to go to Kansas City, which was a major place
shipping hub for livestock.
The cattle.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, they would follow the rails because, well, guess what? There's water along the rail system to water those. So that was a big use in how the windmills expanded out to the west. And then from there, they expanded into the plains and became water pumping windmills for cattle ranchers and so on. So you could see how it kind of rolled out. And over the years, all the way up till about 1954 is when we stopped making them at our Flint and Walling company here in Kendallville, where the museum is. They had improved. It went from wooden windmills to steel mills to highly efficient steel, you know, water pumping mills. And again, if you wanted to share that website link that I gave you with your audience, they could certainly go on and see a history of different mills. There's some 52 windmills on our grounds, and I think there's that many pictures in that link that I sent you. So, but that's how it got started with the rails. Then from there, it spread out past the rails to the cattle ranching industry, and that's how the cattle ranching industry expands. And as you said, as I've driven out west through Montana and out through any of the plain states where there's huge ranches, you'll see a number of water pumping windmills still working today.
And Mike, do you know by chance how many windmills are still in operational order currently?
You know, I couldn't say. I would say there could be several thousand still out there working. If you look at the number of ranches that are out west that still use water pumping now, with the onset of solar being more and more popular, my guess is that some of these water pumping windmills, because parts are getting harder to find, they most of the time have to be custom made, and the maintenance of them are getting to be a chore. But you know, I would just take a guess there'd be 1,000 of them out there, because there were millions of them produced in the United States, you know, from the early onset until the 50s. We had 80 windmill manufacturing companies alone within a 50-mile radius of our location here in the Midwest.
So
that was primarily, go ahead.
Were all of those windmills, if there were 80 locations making them, were they all custom done, or did every windmill making company do something different? Why were there so many?
Yeah, there's a lot of stories about that, and some of the old timers that are still around. Every windmill has a little different way of pumping the water. The gearing mechanism's differently. The power drive, that we call it the motor. It's what sits on the top of the base, and the wheel is attached to it. And they all thought had a little better idea about how they wanted to make that work. And that's a very old one there.
Okay, so the one that we can see on the live stream right now doesn't actually have the big fan blades on it.
No, that's down for repair. There's several of those, but it gives you that would have had a wooden blade on it, and then it would have had that's one of the very early types of metal. That shows you the steel and so on of it, but most of the mills today are all steel, and they have an enclosed motor with self-lubricating gears, and they last a long time. Most of these, like that one with open gears, we have several that are in repair states right now out on our grounds. Our display is all outside except for some of the very valuable wooden mills that are inside our museum barn.
How do you assign a value to them?
You know, that's hard because we had a hailstorm go through here in May.
Oh, my.
That did a considerable amount of damage in the area, and it did some damage to the post mill roof, which is a cedar shake roof, and it did some damage to the wooden windmills. And our insurance, you know, all we could do, they don't know how to really value them. You know, back in the days when they sold, they were sold for just a few $100. But today they're probably averaging between $2,500 and $5,000, depending on, you know, for a normal steel like Flint and Walling windmill.
Absolutely. And again, like you said, a lot of those have to be custom because there are so many different looks to them. Because one of them that you have right now, this is up on our live stream as well for folks to look at. Okay, so the tail is out in front, but instead of the big wheel, it almost looks like the wheel is blowing back. It's as though someone's hair is blowing back in the wind. It's not a flat spinning
that is
wheel.
And that in the back, you see the little bullet in the back, that is a stone counterweight to offset the weight of that one. That mill does not have a tail. Those fins, the blades actually, as the winds get stronger, those bend in like that to come out of the wind, and it's called a self-regulating windmill. That regulates the speed. By it folding in like that, it slows it down so it doesn't, you know, go to a point where it blows itself apart.
Wow.
So that's one of the early self-regulating windmills. The later ones that have the metal wheels and the steel wheels, if you will, and the tails, that what happened there was is they would self-regulate themselves out of the wind stream with a device that would help. As the wind got stronger and turned faster, it would turn the blades out of the wind stream to slow them down. So they were all the later models were all self-regulating.
Do you think that there are folks out there who have some fairly large collections of windmills? Or weights, maybe?
I think there's some that have some collections of windmills. They could have 5 or 10 or 15, for sure. There are a lot of smaller collections around. I don't know of any, you know, locally, because we've collected up a lot of the smaller collections to get our mm-hmm. ours up to the level that it is over the, you know, since 34 years ago. So, but there are still places and pockets out there where there are smaller collections on private farms. We're a nonprofit organization, and we got our start basically from a Flint and Walling company, which is located in Kendallville, Indiana. They started building windmills back in the 1870s, and they continued until 1954.
Wow.
And they still are here in Kendallville making water pumping systems. And we've inherited a lot of their patents and blueprints and operating manuals and so on for their. That's what got the Windmill Museum started in Kendallville, because we had Flint and Walling was like the second largest under the Holiday in later years. They were the second largest water pumping windmill manufacturer in the country. And that was how we got started. Some people said, why don't we have a windmill museum in Kendallville to try to preserve, you know, this heritage? And I know we're probably getting somewhat short on time, but I'll go on to say that I just recently met with our East Noble School Corporation superintendent, along with another board member, and they are interested, actually, at their fourth grade level of having a curriculum that, you know, a part of their school year to teach people, or the students, excuse me, and kind of keep this heritage of what wind power used to be and how the water pumping windmills, you know, used to supply us with water.
Boy, that would be
kind of
cool.
We have a lot of students, like homeschool people, the groups that come out, and we actually have a pumping windmill up on the top of the hill, and I take them out there and disconnect the windmill itself from the hand pump, and I let the kids try to pump that water, and it's a lot of work.
It's a lot
they
of
start
work.
To understand why they developed, you know, a pumping water pumping windmill to help do all that work.
For all of those who've ever been on the handle end of a pump jack, we all just got super tired. We just all remember that.
Yeah, that's right. It's because in order to, you know, we are located in Northeast Indiana, and you may or may not know, but Elkhart and LaGrange County and Elkhart County are our neighbors to the north and a little west. And it's ironic you're a farm-related program. I actually do surveys for the USDA.
Oh, nice.
And I tour a lot of farms up there, Amish farms, and there's still a number of Amish farmers that are still using water-pumping windmills today to water their stock, you know, their cattle and horses. It's pretty neat. And some of them ask me as I'm traveling around, and I happen to have a client that has a windmill, and he said, who do you know that works on them? We do have a gentleman that does repair them here, says on our board of directors. And so there's still a couple people in the area that work on these water pumping windmills today to keep some of the later model metal ones going.
Sure.
I've not seen any wooden ones that are out working, but
just
there's
a
number of the old Flint and Walling windmills around here. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Mike, thank you for joining us today to talk about the windmills and the history of them and so forth. And one more time, can you let folks know where they can find the museum and your website as well?
Yes, our website is midamericanwindmillmuseum.org, all one word. If you Google that, just midamericanwindmillmuseum.org, and that'll take you to our website. It has a, like I said, 52 pictures of mills. It talks about, you know, the admissions schedule, and we really don't charge much to get in here. It's $8 for adults and and $5 for seniors. So we keep our rates low. We don't make our money necessarily on admissions. We make it on other fundraisers we do. But you're welcome to come out. We're open from April until November, and we're open 6 days a week from 10 o'clock in the morning till 4 p.m. in the afternoon, and that's Tuesday through Sunday. We close on Monday. So we're certainly, there's a link in there to communicate to me. If anybody has any questions or needs any other information, feel free to go to that website, and there's a contact us form in there that you can reach us. So
that sounds awesome. Thanks so much, Mike.
No, I appreciate you having us on. The more we get people from all over the country stopping into our little town to see our windmills, and it's through programs like yours that make people aware that we even exist. I've had several come by, and I know we're short of time, but I've had several come in while I was there helping at the Windmill Museum saying, hey, I saw your sign on the street. We never even knew you were here.
That's even better.
We're trying to get more word out. So thank you again for having me today.
Thanks, Mike. And folks, thanks for listening. We'll be right back. Want to check the weather again.
And welcome back to Weather and Ag in Focus. 1:53 in the afternoon. Temperatures outside 8 degrees. That's it. Whopping 8 degrees. And we might make it to 10, but pretty much steady temps the rest of the afternoon. Again, good thing we don't have a thicker snowpack, because that does add to the chill. We would have been probably a little closer to zero if we had a thicker snowpack on the ground. So there's something to be thankful for. Just checking the latest drought monitor index. And from Fargo southward, we are in a what's considered a moderate drought, where areas just north and west of us are fine. The far western part of the state is actually in extreme drought conditions. They really, really need the moisture out west. And there is some over the next week. That's good news. Not a lot, but they will add to their snowpack out to the west, where many areas out in the western part of the state are snow-free. So that's good news there. And like I said, we've got a couple of clipper systems coming our way this week before we start to warm up. And we're looking at quiet weather for today and tomorrow, but cold. We're not going to break out of the single digits today and tomorrow. But as we head into midweek, by Wednesday, we should start to move up at least into the teens. And then 20s on Thursday. That'll feel like a heat wave, but there's a clipper system that'll bring some light snow on Thursday. We'll see a break Friday, and then later Saturday into Sunday, there's another clipper system coming our way. That one might pack a little more punch. We'll have to keep an eye on that one. And after that one, there's a couple more before the end of the month. So at least we're seeing some chances of snowpack and moisture. That's good news. These clipper systems don't typically have a lot of moisture associated with them. But again, each one could drop down, 1 to 3 inches each time, and you get two or three of those coming through before the end of the month, and that could add to the snowpack, which, again, we really, really, really could use it, and we'll see a little bit more as we head throughout the end of the month. And again, February, later in February into March and early April, that's when I think we're going to start seeing at least chances for stormier weather in terms of more moisture moving up here. But January is typically a drier month compared to as we head into spring, and that's exactly how it's panning out this year.
Well, we will see what spring looks like. We're a little ways away. I was asked today when I think we might plant small grains. It just depends on how things go. We could do it at the end of March, but the chances are high it'd probably be into April. And you'll have plenty of folks who say, wait a minute, you're actually going to plant small grains? Well, they might. We'll see what that looks
like.
Yeah,
and we're going to make, according to the LRC, we should flip the switch pretty quickly in March a quick end of winter, at least in terms of temperature-wise. That doesn't mean we'll be done with the snow, but any snow we get wouldn't last long with temperatures as warm as they're expected to be it looks like mid-March onward.
Yeah.
So that's good news.
We'll probably warm up quite a bit.
Yeah.
Get all your ice fishing in. And we are currently making ice.
Yeah. No
plenty of it.
No doubt about it. It's been definitely cold enough, that's for sure. And don't see anything really above freezing for any extended period of time. Our LRC does have a minor January thaw about the third week. Could last about 3 to 5 days, and then that's it.
Yeah, that's we're going to get.
Back to the cold weather after that.
So right now, one of the things that has happened because of the whole Ukrainian-Russian war is not just what folks have suffered in those in those two countries. But it really, the stakes are much higher. The United Nations Food and Ag Association models suggest that more than 13 million people can be undernourished due to Russia and Ukraine's war. Ukraine's last production of about three different winter cereals have really affected about 76 million adults. So the study, so it's not just the 13 million people that would be undernourished, but then the caloric counts of 76 million adults as well. Who's being affected most closely? Ukraine sold to a lot of countries that didn't just border them, but they were probably more developing countries that were looking for a lower priced grain. Not always lower quality, maybe somewhat lower quality than what they buy in North America or Australia. But what has happened is these lower income nations in Africa, like Sierra Leone, the Congo, Somalia, also Albania and Belarus, they have all been affected as well. And so they've had to go look for other places to buy grain wherever they can, which is costing them more money, which unfortunately translates to less people being able to actually be affected and be able to get more food in their diet. So really, it's not just about what's happened in those two countries. It's what it's done to the entire region. So much more of those things to talk about tomorrow. And we hope that you're back with us then.
Yeah, so for Bridget, myself, I want to thank everybody for joining us. Don't go anywhere. The Jay Thomas Show is coming up next.